But then the conservatives say, yeah, but you have no reason for presuming that injunction. There's nothing in your son is born that implies look at him. So the answer is, okay, the grounds for the presumption is that otherwise you can't explain how this could have ever been understood. You could have never learned as a child what the sentence means unless there was such an injunction, like look at him. Now, this next sentence I yesterday did some revising, so it reads a little bit different. Maybe it makes some more sense the way I fix the translation. But no, the reason given that the capacity for meaning is found only in words that are connected through other words in a statement to an enjoined action. I filled that out a little bit. The capacity for meaning is found only in words that are connected through other words in a sentence to an enjoined action. Remember, in this Prabhakara theory, both sides, words have meaning only inside a sentence by their syntactic anvaya, syntactic connection with the other words. And there should be, through that syntactic connection with the other words, there's got to be ultimately some connection with an action that needs to be done. But the reason is not even valid. Repeat. But no. The reason given that the capacity for meaning is found only in words that are connected through other words in a statement to an enjoined action is not even valid. Not valid because it's not true all the time. That's technically called anaikantika. It's true some of the time, but not all the time, so it can't be used as a general principle. If there was fire sometimes when there's smoke, not all the time, then it wouldn't be a universal principle. It would be an invalid reason, because it's not always true. If I said, men are Republicans, Republican Party. That's not true. Some men are Republicans. Not all of them. Some of them are Democrats, or fascists, or communists. So if I give an argument, all men are Republicans. Socrates is a man, therefore Socrates is a Republican. It's an invalid reasoning because the reason, the hetu, is invalid. It's not even valid. Why isn't it valid? So we have to use the other ablatives to give the reason for the reason. It's not valid. It's not obvious that it's not valid, but the reason why it's not valid, two reasons. Since it fails to be true in the case of the very word that expresses action. This word is not connected through other words with something that needs to be done. What word is that? It's the verb. The verb, okay, not saying now. I made this clearer. I'm not saying the verb has no syntactic connection with the other words. Of course, the syntax goes both directions. But it's not connected through other words with something. I'm sorry. Yeah, this word is not connected through other words with something that needs to be done. Why? Because by itself, it's connected with what needs to be done. In an injunctive sentence, the verb itself, without considering its connection with other words, by itself, it indicates the action that should be done. So the rule that the words only have meaning in connection with the other words doesn't fit, doesn't apply to the verb. Does that make sense? No? Yes? Yes? Well, starting from where? The beginning of the paragraph?
No,
since it fails to be true in the case of the very word that expresses action. I put a semicolon after that. In the case of the very word that expresses action. And I'll clarify in the commentary that this is the verb. I just didn't want to add too much to the translation. I'll explain it a little further in the commentary. This word is not connected through other words with something that needs to be done. Period. Yes. What? Sorry? Oh, my Krishna. He's giving the reason why the reason is not valid. The reason given is not even valid. Why? For this reason. It's a because clause. This is so, since, or because. Should I use the word because instead of since? No, it doesn't make any difference. Okay? I'm saying it's not a valid reason, since this is the case. Okay. What are they? Okay, I started the class with that. Going back. Oh boy. There was two alternatives. One of them was that a statement of fact doesn't have a connection with an action that needs to be done. Or even doesn't have a connection with any action that will let you know what the sentence means. Because you have to see the thing acted out to know to have learned what it means. That's the theory. So therefore, we have the example of a son has been born to you. That's a statement of fact, and there's no connection with anything that needs to be done there. Therefore, it can't have, again, have real meaning, according to Prabhakaras. That's the conservatives talking. The radicals say, no, there's an implied injunction. It's, look at him. Is implied. And the conservatives say, why is it implied? There's nothing in there, in that statement, a son has been born, to make you imply it. And the radicals say, yes, there is. The fact that if you didn't presume an injunction, you couldn't have ever learned what the sentence means in the first place. That's the argument. And then the conservatives come back again. That you give the reason that capacity of meaning is found only in words that are connected to the other words in the sentence through an enjoined action. That's the radical view. Your reason is not even valid because it's not true all the time. It's not true in the case of the very verb in the sentence. Because the verb in the sentence expresses its meaning all by itself. It doesn't need to be connected to any of the words to give its meaning. Verb is independent. All the other words are dependent on the verb. That's how grammarians view syntax. The verb is the independent center of the sentence. Does that make sense? That's the argument, yes?
Hare Krishna. Looks like Mimamsakas have a very truncated concept of an action or injunction, because, for instance, the statement that the son has been born to you.
That's not an injunction.
Could be interpreted as an injunction.
It's an action. Taking birth is an action.
I mean, it could be interpreted as an injunction. As
how?
In the sense that now you should accept it as true. You should understand it's a statement, and now,
no,
in other words, they exclude mental activities from the whole realm of injunctions. Like when the Vedas say that, since, for instance, that Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead, this is not an injunction in a physical sense, but it's an injunction in a mental, intellectual sense, because now we have to accept it, and they exclude it altogether.
It's an interesting theory, but I don't think anyone's ever come up with that in the history of Mimamsa. Yeah, you could find a Mimamsa and try out your theory with him and see what he says. Later. You know, you can add a new life to the debate with the Mimamsakas. But I don't think this idea has been tried out before. It's interesting.
Yeah, I'm aware about it. But
that statements of fact are injunctions.
They're injunctions.
You know, the son has been born. Believe it or not. You know, believe it or else. You know, that's the injunction.
Yeah, it's implied believe because it's a factual statement, so it's imperative to accept it.
Well, you're saying that a truth, a proposition, which is a true or false statement, is an injunction, because it's enjoining, accept that it's true.
Otherwise,
if you don't believe me, it's true.
Otherwise, if you don't accept the definition of an injunction, then
yeah, but then see that not, that really plays havoc with the whole Mimamsaka viewpoint that only the injunctions are significant. If you let all truth-false statements, all propositions also be injunctions, then every single sentence is basically an injunction. There's no distinction. You've destroyed the distinction between injunctions and other sentences.
No, we don't destroy because...
At least between injunctions and statements of fact. If you state a fact, it's either true or false. And you're implying, believe it, it's true. But then you make all... At least almost all the statements of the Vedas, which are either injunctions... Okay, all the statements of the Vedas that are injunctions or statements of fact are injunctions, and we don't have any distinction.
But we don't.
You destroyed... Okay, you have destroyed the difference between an injunction and an artavada. Because most of the artavada statements are statements of fact. And now you're saying they're also injunctions. You've destroyed a very important distinction in Mimamsa. I don't think they're going to like that.
Well, that's okay. They don't have to, but...
No, we can just say, throw their whole theory in the garbage, but they're not going to like it.
Because just logically speaking, if they don't accept that statement that statements of fact in the Vedas are also injunctions, then they cannot even accept injunctions as injunctions because injunctions in the Vedas are based on statements of the facts.
But who are you talking to?
To
who are you telling this?
To Mimamsakas.
Well, it's like telling a Catholic that the Pope is a jerk. He's not going to accept that. He's not, it may be true, but he's not going to accept it. If he's a Catholic, if he's a real Catholic.
Okay.
So you're asking them to reject their own siddhanta, their own assumptions.
Yeah, that's true.
That's pretty radical. I mean, I don't know. Some of these Mimamsakas can be pretty mean. I wouldn't... anyway.
Not giving some
the thing side. Is, what we're conducting here is an internal debate among the Mimamsakas. So your idea is not going to fit in this paragraph. We can add a paragraph later on with your idea, but it doesn't fit in this discussion. This is an internal discussion between two parties of the Prabhakaras who all share the assumption that injunctions are one thing and artavadas or statements of fact are another thing. So they don't want to hear this from you. Not now. We just wait.
But in the context of Tattva Sandarbha, Jiva Goswami shows that collision between the two.
No, but the way Jiva Goswami handles it, he lets them have their say, Tweedledum and Tweedledee, battling it out. And then, at the end, he says, we don't accept this assumption that only the injunctions are significant. That's how Jiva Goswami handles it. He says, statements of fact are just as important. And also you learn what words mean, also from statements of fact. That's how Jiva Goswami handles it. You want to try a different way than saying the statements of fact are injunctions. It's interesting, but it doesn't fit in here. Jiva Goswami didn't try that, and the Mimamsas are not going to consider that among themselves. It's extraneous. It's interesting. We could put it in as an appendix, but it's not following the argument. Okay. I won't say it's irrelevant, but it's extraneous to the train of thought.
But it's a powerful way of arguing with people sometimes. You just take their statement and you show its inconsistency, because if you state about injunctions as being imperative, then you show that the statements of the facts are also, by all for all intents and purposes, are injunctions.
Okay, but what Jiva Goswami is doing here, he's not a third party in the debate. He's just reporting what they say among themselves. So let's keep it to that at this point. Jiva Goswami is explaining to us what they say to each other. It's not that Jiva Goswami is going to butt in and say, hey, both of you are jerks, and it's like this. He'll do that at the end when they're done talking. Okay? And don't expect that the arguments are going to be completely, make complete sense. Because they don't, they're not thinking with complete clarity. That's a point, but that would be the point. What you do is you let the Purvapaksha have his say. Then you tear him apart. But be fair. Let him have, it's his turn, let him talk. And then when he's done, then you let him have it. Okay, so let's get through this. Now, there's a second reason why the reason is invalid. What's the reason? Again, what's the reason that that's invalid?
First reason. How many reasons do we have?
No, not the reason for the reason. The first reason. The initial reason. There are two reasons for the first reason. What was that first reason? You have it right there in front of you. Oh, I'm sorry, no. But the reason given that the capacity for meaning is found only in words that are connected to other words in a statement to an enjoined action. That reason. It's not valid because it's not true in the case of the verb. Now, a second problem with that reason. Moreover, this sentence has also been changed a little bit. Moreover, were a relationship of meaning to be known as proposed simply from a statement's connection with some suitable idea external to it. I added that, external to it. Some suitable idea, instead of saying other suitable idea, that's vague. I made it a little specific by saying some suitable idea external to it. That means it's not in the sentence. There's some idea in a different sentence that it's connected to. That's like, your son has been born. That's a sentence, right? And the second sentence is, look at him. So the idea that's going to fill in the gap is in a different sentence. It's external to the given to the first sentence. So, moreover, were a relationship of meaning to be known as proposed simply from a statement's connection with some suitable idea external to it, the words modifying the statement's verb would become useless. Son has been born. We understand what that means because there's an injunction, look at him, connected to it. Now, that's the purpose of saying your son has been born, to let you know now it's time to look at him. You know, it has to be injunction is the real purpose, the real meaning. So if we know that from the second sentence, look at him, then all these extra words in the first sentence are not needed. The adjectives and the karakas and everything, who needs them? We know what it means from the second idea, look at him, which has nothing to do with the adjectives, the verbs, the adjectives, nouns, prepositions, and other words in the first sentence. So they all become useless, or how do you say, unnecessary, superfluous. Redundant is to say something a second, say something twice. But it's not necessary. Anyway, I hope that's clear enough, and it'll be further explained in the commentary. Any problems with that? With that sentence, or can we move on? You see how it is another reason why that reason is not valid? Okay. Let's just live with it and move on. Unless somebody wants to object to question. Okay, looks like everyone's had enough of it and wants to move on. Okay. Yeah, and I don't know what we accomplished in that week, but anyway. Okay, next. The last two sentences of the Sanskrit. Nacha karye karyanvitan taratvam astiti vachyam tadanvita va ayogad anavasta patescha nacha karyanvitatva eva pratikamapa shakti grahaniyamaha siddhanudeshe pi balaka vyutpattir drishyate idam vastram ityadau. Okay, now, nor should it even be suggested that something that needs to be done can have a connection with something else that needs to be done. Why would you suggest that? Because, like you, I say, what's the purpose, what's the meaning and purpose of your son has been born? And you suggest, look at him. And I'll say, well, what's the meaning or purpose of look at him? Or what's the connection? and you say, there's a previous injunction. What's the connection? Why do you presume the unspoken injunction? Look at him. What's your grounds? What's your reason for presuming it? And then I say, then it said an answer, there is, you forget, an injunction in the Vedas. When your son is born, you have to look at him within 6 hours or else. You know, there is no such injunction, but let's presume, you know, they're making one up. Well, that's a problem. You're justifying your presumption by another presumption. Then you're going to need a third presumption to justify the second one, and a fourth one to justify the third one. It'll go on forever. Nor should it be even suggested that something that needs to be done can have a connection with something else that needs to be done, since there is no reason for linking one with the other, and indeed, an endless regression would result. Okay. Is that, those two sentences, okay enough? Dr. Gopal. There'll be some further explanation in the commentary of that.
Yes. But after this next paragraph, I have a question.
After the next paragraph. Let me do the next paragraph. Okay, this one's easier. And now it's really Jiva Goswami talking. Nor is it a hard... Because the Prabhakaras won't say this. Mimamsakas won't say this. This is the Jiva Goswami talking. I don't think we have to say that. You can figure that out. That if you know Mimamsakas, you know that they wouldn't say this last paragraph. Nor is it a hard and fast rule that meaning first learned must be connected with something that needs to be done. It's just not a rule. We see that a child may come to a proper understanding even in a matter-of-fact statement, as when he is told, this is a piece of cloth. Okay, I think that makes sense without further explanation. So at the end we say, anyway, their assumption is not true anyway. That there has to be a connection with an injunction whenever you learn what a word means. It's not true. Okay. Let me read from the commentary. Let me read the whole commentary. See if we have any problems with the commentary. I made a few changes there too. In the exchange of objections and replies between the two parties of Prabhakara Mimamsakas, the proponents of the second view, that statements need not always relate to something needing action. Yeah. The Prabhakaras, all of them, share the assumption, the belief, that words only have meaning in the context of the whole sentence. But it's the radical ones who say that syntactic connection between the words in a sentence also has to point to an action that needs to be done. The Mimamsakas in general say the only really significant sentences are the ones that are injunctions. But now, the radical Prabhakaras are saying all statements have somehow or other, indirectly, some connection with an injunction, at least when the way you learned the sentence in the first place as a child. That's the proponents of the second view, the radicals. No, I'm sorry, the second view are the conservatives. The proponents of the second view, that statements need not always relate to something needing action, ask their opponents what a declarative sentence lacks that prevents it from expressing a direct meaning. Declarative is a simple statement of fact. After posing this question, they themselves offer two possible replies. One is that mere statements of fact do not elicit active responses that enable observers to learn the meanings of the words used. The other is that there is no such thing as a mere statement of fact at all, because every statement has some connection with an action that needs to be done. Both replies are invalid. Statements of fact do evoke responses in their hearers. Responses that inform the hearers about a conversation's meaning. And many simple declarative statements have no link to a need to do something. Persons who insist that there is a link may presume there is an unspoken injunction behind every statement of fact, but this presumption has no apparent justification. Someone may suggest that young Chaitra, not Chaitra who just had his son, but Chaitra when he was a boy, young boy Chaitra, could have originally learned the meaning of the statement, "A son has been born to you," only in the context of hearing an injunction to a father, such as "take a look at him." He was in the hospital to get his tonsils taken out, and he overheard this conversation. "Mr. Smith, your son has been born. Take a look at him." And that's how Chaitra learned what "your son is born" means. There must have been an implied action on Chaitra's part, such as "take a look at him." That is, the statement used again in the second circumstance. I'm sorry. I skipped over two sentences. And so, when Chaitra himself becomes a father for the first time and is told, "A son has just been born to you," there must be an implied action on Chaitra's part, such as "take a look at him." That is, the statement used again in a second circumstance must still imply an injunction to act. The proponents of the second view respond with several objections. First, grammatically or logically, nothing inherent in the statement "a son has been born" implies you should look at him. I'm afraid the word "several" is problematic. There's only two objections.
There's three.
There's three. Oh, no. No, we had one and two reasons for the one. And now I'm listening as three in the commentary. Ay, ay, ay. Okay, two or three. I have to make a question to myself and sort it out. Because in the translation, we present it as one reason and two reasons for the reason. In the commentary, I'm going back to an older version where I had three reasons. Two reasons or three. Okay, anyway, that can be fixed. But let me just read it the way it is now. The proponents of the second view respond with several objections. First, grammatically or logically, nothing inherent in the statement "a son has been born" implies you should look at him. If Chaitra had instead been told, "a big angry bull is running toward you," one could easily infer that because, as a rule, big angry bulls are dangerous, Chaitra should do something also to avoid this one. But "a son has been born to you" doesn't necessarily imply the imperative "you should look at him." No reason. Second, in an imperative sentence, the verb itself breaks the rule that all meaningful words must have at least an implied link to an enjoined action. That is to say, in an imperative sentence, I think the problem is that first paragraph, okay, anyway, I'll work on it. There's really only two reasons. The first reason is something other than what I said. Don't worry about it. Second, in an imperative sentence, the verb itself breaks the rule that all meaningful words must have at least an implied link to an enjoined action. That is to say, in an imperative sentence, the verb itself expresses what needs to be done, and it is the main word of the sentence. The subject, predicate, and modifiers are all syntactically subordinate to the verb. I changed the word "connected" to "subordinate." But the verb is independent, and I change the rest. Therefore, an imperative verb has no syntactic relation to other words expressing action. No. I'm sorry, hold on a second.
I made a change and it's not showing there. No, I'm sorry. It's actually a different change. Can I read that sentence again? Because I didn't read the change I made. The subject, predicate, and modifiers are all syntactically subordinate to the verb. But the verb is independent. But I don't want to say the verb has no syntactic connection. It does. So what I say instead is, but the verb is independent. It refers to the action of the statement by its own power without needing to be defined with the help of the other words. That's true. Okay, now what we do is delete the rest of this paragraph and delete the next paragraph. We just forget they ever existed. Then we start third. Yeah. But the verb is independent, semicolon. It refers to the action of the statement by its own power. Without needing to be defined. With the help of the other words. The help of the other words. Delete the rest of the paragraph after that, when a child learns, all that, and delete the next paragraph. Okay? It refers to the action of the statement by its own power, comma. Okay? Without needing to be defined. With the help of the other words. Period. Third, besides the verb, other words in a sentence have meaningful syntactic connection with one another. No matter how 3-year-old Chaitra learned what the words son, born, and your mean, now that Chaitra is grown up, he can easily piece together the idea of your son has been born, without having to conjure up any injunction. Putting the words into Sanskrit, let's take the sentence Tava Putra Jataha. Your son has been born. If Chaitra knows enough Sanskrit grammar, he will recognize Putraha as a subject case noun. Jata as a passive participle, serving as the verb of the sentence. And te as a short form of the possessive pronoun tava, your. The verb has its subject, and the subject its possessive modifier. Thus, with no need for any injunction of an action yet undone, these three words, with their grammar and their dictionary meanings, express the complete idea, and Chaitra should be able to understand it. Okay, well, that's not what the conservative Prabhakaras are saying. That's what we're saying. That's what we would say. So I have to rephrase. This is not first, second, third reason. We're sort of giving our own reasons here, at least the third one. I'll rephrase it so it comes out right. As a last resort for salvaging the rule that all words must link with something to be done, one might propose that imperative verbs connect with other unspoken imperatives. One could assume that the word look, in you should look at him, is connected with a previous injunction like, for the good fortune of one's newborn child, one should take a look at him at once. But what logical reason sustains this assumption? The supposed injunction that one needs to look at a newborn child is not recorded in any shastra. Other attempts to manufacture previous injunctions will also result in imaginary injunctions or pairs of injunctions that don't follow logically from one another. And applying thoroughly the rule that injunctions by implication must be connected with previous injunctions would result in an infinite regress, each imperative needing support from an infinity of previous ones. That's the end of the commentary. Okay, just this thing about there being several reasons. This is reason one, two, three. That's not right. I have to fix that. Are you sure, Prabhu? Oh, okay. So let's make it tapo to ajata. Can I mark that right here? Give me a few seconds. Well, I don't have to check with Jayadwaita Maharaj over that. We changed tava putrajata to te putrajata. You can't do that. Te has to come in a second position, doesn't it? Putras te jata, huh? You're not allowed to start with te, are you? Okay, let's get rid of te. Let's just say tava putrajata. Now let's forget about te. Example? Okay, I'm going to... No more te. Tava putrajata. And tava is a possessive pronoun. Parenthesis, your. How's that? No, like this. And tava, parenthesis, your, is a possessive pronoun. Okay. Thank you for correcting that. But I just made an instant change. It's now fixed. Okay. We will stop there. We have gotten to the end of the paragraph. Any more comments about it? We should bake a cake and have a party. We finished the paragraph. Yes, ma'am. Microphone.
Maybe I'm trying to get ahead of time, but what is our idea about verbs?
Now we can talk about our ideas. We're done with them.
Okay, what about...
Now we can talk, what we believe. Yes.
What's our idea about verbs and nouns? It looks like verbs and nouns are interdependent in the sense that nouns denote subjects, or objects, and verbs refer to relations between the objects, and this way they're interrelated. And
no, I don't know. Who says that?
Yes,
verbs describe relations between the, let's say, the karakas. There's different kinds of karakas. Object is one kind of karaka. But that's not the way grammarians, including Jiva Goswami, presents it. The karakas are dependent on the verb. The karakas belong to the verb. They don't say it the other way around, that the verbs are just relationships between the karakas. The verbs are primary. That's the general theory of the Sanskrit grammarians, that a sentence is, first of all, the verb, and then other things are added to it.
I'm not talking about grammar syntax here, but I'm talking about real things, such words
words,
nouns.
Words are grammatical things. You want to talk about ontology, words are just puffs of air from the ontological point of view.
I want to talk about ontology because they refer to different things.
But words are a special kind of thing, and words are described by the science of grammar. You want to leave the grammarians out of it. That's not fair. We're going to talk about words, but we don't want the grammarians to be involved.
They may be described by the rules of grammar, but they're primary to the grammar itself, because first they exist in the real, and then they're described.
Words? What's the existence of words outside of what's described in grammar?
No, we have concepts. We have concepts as...
No, words have meanings. You can say that a word is a connection between a sound and a meaning. Words have, meaning is a component of a word, or it's the word points to a meaning. But meanings and words are not the same thing.
No, I was talking about verbs, not words.
Verbs are also words.
Yeah, it is a word, but...
Actions are things, that's okay. But verbs describe actions.
So if we just steer clear of verbs and they want to discuss actions and objects... So this is what I want to ask you about. Is looks like nouns describe objects and verbs describe actions or relations between objects, because otherwise action cannot be defined.
Okay, but that's
That's like, I don't know who, you know, like, even in modern semantics, I don't know if they formulate it like that. There is, I mean, although the grammarians don't deal on that level, the Navinyaya theoreticians do, trying to analyze ontological categories, but they do it in grammatical terms. You know, they don't just ignore the grammatical theory, they use it on a higher level. The Navinyaya, you know, are doing similar, what the kind of thing you're trying to do right now. Analyze the real action and the real things out there. The things that are described by words. But they do that, but they do it grammatically. They do it following the rules of grammar. They still put the verb in the center. They still give primacy to the verb. These ontologists who are trying to analyze reality, they do it linguistically. The Navinyaya school. So you're how are you doing it? Give me your theory.
No, but if we are trying to discuss something, anything, we are definitely governed by the rules of language, and in this particular.
No, I don't mean like that. That you have to use language to say what you have to say. I'm saying that they. Anyway, they have a linguistic, a grammatical way of a grammatical model of reality. They don't say that reality has a different logic than the logic of grammar. You're presenting a different logic of the relationships of reality. Okay, but that's yours. That's your theory.
Well, not my friends. Take Krishna for example.
Krishna,
presumptuous as it may be. Krishna is a Vastu, and that verse, Parasya Shakti Vidhaiva Shruti Svabhaviki, looks like that verse describes Krishna as a Vastu and actions.
Krishna is playing his flute, isn't it?
In other words, he is a support of actions, and actions are secondary to Krishna. But we take his actions and his relations to us as other Vastus as the means to know for knowing Krishna. In other words, for us, they're primary, but Krishna as the real object, or the object, the real support of everything that exists, he is, if you express him in grammatical terms, is a noun,
yes, yes.
Not a verb.
Yes.
Verbs are shaktis, and they spread from Krishna. And we're also vastus, and the relation between us and him and with
okay,
us
you're
and
saying you're saying that the vastu, is the especially in the case of Krishna, the absolute truth. The absolute truth is a vastu, not an activity.
Not a shakti.
Yes.
It becomes like New Age kind of thing.
Well, because, you know why? Because the absolute truth is unchanging. If the absolute truth was always in a state of flux, then the verb might describe it nicely. But because the absolute truth is something that doesn't change, it should be described as a thing described by a noun. You know, just like if you said God is love, you know, I worship love. Love is an activity.
Yes.
You know, and then I've reduced God to an energy. You know, I don't separate. I you know, the energy is God for me.
Exactly.
You know, I'm a Shakta. God is love.
Yes.
Then I describe the absolute truth by a verb. It's an activity.
It's a
constant state of change.
Yeah.
But our view of God is an unchanging God. You know, his pastimes are have changes, but that's his Shaktis. He possesses the Shaktis, and he's a Vastu. He's an unchanging Vastu. Therefore, we use a noun to describe the absolute truth, Brahman or Krishna. Yeah, that's our view of reality, that the absolute truth is a thing, and it's a constant thing. Therefore,
excuse me, maybe I have to hijack the whole discussion. Maybe Nityananda Prabhu wants to make a point. I'll give the microphone.
No, but what's your point? I want to understand it. Therefore,
was that Krishna grammatically maybe? So maybe accepted as a common ground for meaningful grammatical discussion or syntax,
yes.
As verbs are primary.
Yes.
But in the real world, the word which all the words, including verbs and nouns, point out to, nouns of Krishna is the primary. But Shaktis, which Krishna has, are described by verbs, and therefore they're interdependent. But Krishna is the resting point of verbs and activities.
Yes.
That's the statement.
Well, the Shaktis are described both as verbs and nouns. Just like you have the Srimati Radharani is a Vastu, and then she's also the energy. She's the proprietor or the presiding deity of the energies.
Yes, that's true.
Both. So the Shakti is both. Yeah, sure.
Okay, but our discussion up to this point has been within the scope and the assumptions of Mimamsaka, Mimamsa philosophy. Okay, where, you know, we're talking about the words, the statements of the Vedas, and what do they mean. Mimamsa is looking at word, at language. Okay? Mimamsa view doesn't care about the absolute truth. It cares about what are we supposed to do? What's our duty? Atato dharma gigasa. Not let us investigate the absolute truth, let's investigate our duty. And that's something to be done. Therefore, we put emphasis on activity in the Mimamsa worldview. But now we've finished the paragraph, we can put it aside and go back to our own reality, where Krishna is in the center, Krishna and his Shaktis. Yes? Yeah. Could you give Nityananda Prabhu the microphone? Well, we had stopped anyway. We finished 42. We start 43 tomorrow. You don't have the numbers in front of you anyway, but we start the next paragraph tomorrow. It was a convenient break. Okay? Anything else?
I don't understand your usage of the word ontology.
Epistemology and ontology. Epistemology is...
How do you spell ontology?
O-N-T-O-L-O-G-Y.
O is ontology.
Ontology. Yeah. It's the study of what exists.
Okay, because I understand...
Epistemology is the study of how do you know anything. And ontology is, well, what is there out there to know? You know, how do you know anything? Well, what are the things? What are the things is the question of ontology. What exists? What is there? Epistemology has to come first. You can't answer what exists unless you have a way of knowing something. So first of all, answer the question, how do you know anything? And then, what is the anything you can know? That's the second question. Okay, we stop here. Thank you. All glories to Srila Prabhupada, Srimad Bhagavatam, Tatva Sandarbha Ki Jai.